Stories from Down Under. Tina Gardo und Marc Dechmann im Gespräch mit David Denborough, Autor des Buchs Collective Narrative Practice, Dozent für Narrative Practice am Dulwich Center in Adelaide, Australien. In der Tradition von Michael und Cheryl White. Einer, der mit blitzenden Augen erzählt. Einer, der denen die Stimme zurückgibt, die am meisten zu einem neuen Narrativ beitragen können. Einer, der Perspektiven, der Geschichte und Geschichten verwebt und dessen Perspektive auf eine neue Utopie Beziehung ist. David spricht von seiner eigenen Suche nach Paulo Freire. You look for answers in the wrong places. Und er spricht davon, was das für ihn heißt.
Das neue Normal. Was steht jetzt eigentlich an? Unser Podcast in der zweiten Staffel mit Marc Dechmann, Roberto Isberna und Tina Gardo. Die letzten Monate haben die Welt, Europa, Deutschland, unser Alltagsempfinden mehr verändert als die letzten Jahre. Warum ist das so? Und vor allem, wo kann uns das hinführen? Wo soll uns das hinführen? Und was brauchen wir dafür?
I would say good morning, David, because here in Berlin and in Hamburg it's morning. What about you? You are talking with us from far away. Is it good evening? Late afternoon?
Late afternoon, beautiful summer's day, 32 degrees, blue skies. I've had the great pleasure of two swims, so I know I shouldn't be talking too much about these things at this moment when speaking to those in the Northern Hemisphere. So, yeah.
So now tell us, from where do you call?
Well, I'm in a place that is usually referred to as Adelaide in South Australia. But these days in Australia, we're also starting any conversation by acknowledging the First Nations people. So the much longer histories. And this place is known as Kaurna country. So it's the land of the Kaurna people. So I'm in, that's where I am. Yes, far from you. It's a coastal city. It's also got some hills not far away, not mountains, just hills. But it's a beautiful land, the land of the Kaurna people.
Mark, have you traveled to this beautiful land? Or when did this idea came to your mind to invite David Denborough to our podcast?
Actually, I've never been there physically, but mentally probably a couple of times because of David's connection to the Dulwich Center. And that is a origin of a line of thoughts that I can recommend strongly. The idea to invite you, David, comes from Vienna, and you had a workshop with us at the ESBA, and we were talking about storytelling and about narratives, narrative practice, and you were introducing the magic of words, rescuing words. That's a sentence I received from you about the magic that can come if you really try to understand the magic behind the words, to connect via narratives. And I still can see David starting the workshop saying, look, I suggest that I will sing a song and then everybody of you will sing a song. Is that okay? And then he started singing and he has a beautiful voice and we all said, gosh, oh God. And we all were coaches, etc. So we were used to the stage, but not that way. So I loved that one. It was also the start of my and a couple of our my fellows' journey in narrative practice, where we felt like you made a strong impression on us, and that was also because you introduced a certain perspective on society, as we just learned, the Kaurna country, and others simply would refer to Australia and Adelaide, and that is why I felt the intuition of a rich conversation, David. But if I say that, we just had literally 3 days and obviously the more distant emails, etc. So, do I paint a picture of you that you feel fine with? Or would you say, like, okay, that's interesting what this guy tells about me?
No, I vividly recall my visits to Vienna. And I remember the workshop that you were in. And I've really appreciated each of those workshops. People have engaged with significant intellect and rigor, but also creativity and delight, really. And yeah, we're in Vienna, so we had to start with a song, surely. But actually, I believe in often starting with song or including song within workshops. My work is often in collaboration with others and responding to significant suffering, whether in communities here in Australia or elsewhere. And song and music can play a real part in sustaining people through hardships. And within sort of psychology and social work and some of those professions, song and other forms of folk culture got a bit marginalized. And of course, the irony is some of this actually originated from Vienna, where, you know, psychoanalytic understandings originated. But yeah, there's a bit of a long story in bringing music and folk culture back to professional fields as part of responding to social suffering. So yeah, no, I appreciate you mentioning how we started with a song, and I appreciated how you and the others really engaged with different media, different artistic practice in your work and in that workshop.
David, if we start that way, and if you recall, what is the first time you experienced yourself in connections as an effective part of society or community as a bigger whole? Can you remember the situation when you first time had the feeling like, oh, I'm in this impactful connection?
Well, I would probably refer back to when I was growing up in the 1980s. So particularly say when I was about 13 or 14, so we're talking 1983, 1984, the Cold War was a very significant feature, as was the nuclear arms race. And my parents, rather than only despairing about the state of the world, and they did have considerable angst and worry about the state of the world, but they also took action. So they actually formed, just in our, you know, around our dining room table, they got together with a number of others and formed what ended up being a political party called the Nuclear Disarmament Party. It was a party that was just determined to hold the other major parties to account and try and separate Australia from the madness of the nuclear arms race and US bases and being just a continuing part of US imperialism, really. So when you ask that question, I immediately think of that in the face of, you know, overwhelming situation where you really feel completely powerless, what on earth can people do in any one household or in any one part of the world? They just took action, created little news sheets on the table. In those days, it was all pre-computer. And this was linked to a broader social movement, you know, thousands upon thousands of people marching, taking action. So that was very formative for me in terms of just, yeah, trying to be a part, making some contribution, joining with others around whatever social issues, you know, the most pressing, sometimes devastating, needing a response.
I have this picture in mind now, you at the table with your parents and just doing something and then realizing that you're not the only one and there are others, you are joining in a group, in a community. I would like to ask you a bit deeper what you felt in that specific moment when you were with others in this idea of let's just come to action.
I don't know if I can say exactly what I felt at 13 or 14. It was all, you know, I was also meeting some extraordinary people who were dedicating their lives to try to take action, and people would come for dinner, sit around the dining room table, and they'd be from ex-military people who had seen the madness of militarism to long-term peace activists to women's activists. So, I mean, I was pretty open-eyed and just trying to take it all in. But your question about, you know, the significance of being joined with others, that is certainly something that I profoundly treasure. And really, when I left school, I was at a privileged all-boys school. And by the time I finished it, although I found it easy to succeed in such a culture, it was an alienating culture and an isolating culture. And it was only one of the things that profoundly drew me to narrative practice and the work that I've been involved in since, is that I came across a newsletter while I was working in prisons, actually. Someone passed me this newsletter and they thought I might be interested in it. And they knew I was very passionate about trying to address men's violence and try to understand the craziness that is masculinity, at least here in Australia, but I think probably also in Germany. Masculinity, dominant masculinity, does such incredible harm in so many ways and relationships. So I was searching for this. Anyway, this newsletter that came, and how it relates to your question, is that it was created through partnership. It was men and women working together to try to address issues of gender injustice. And this, I'd been reading everything I could read about masculinity and gender relations and men's violence. But this was the only thing I'd read that was like a partnership between men and women working together to look at masculinity. And that probably, you know, echoed with my experiences from my childhood home in terms of, yes, there's a possibility of doing things together. But it also was just incredibly exciting for me to think that as a man or as a person of privilege, these partnerships could be possible, and then we could work together to try and respond to these issues. So that was the opening of renewed possibilities and what has been a source of absolute joy, actually, to be able to join with others, even if trying to respond to some pretty horrid, sorrowful things, to be doing this together is incredibly sustaining, incredibly meaningful for me, at least.
What was the secret of the success that men and women work together in this, like, to my understanding, constructive way? How did they do this, which in all of the other parts was not possible at that point of time?
Well, there's a long history to that. And there's actually a really beautiful conversation between Cheryl White and Taimalie Kiwi-Tamasisi, who's a Samoan woman. And it's a conversation where they talk about gender and culture and partnerships that are required. And there's a long story that Cheryl tells about how she was really been doing so much work with women, and she was wanting to offer anything that she could do in relation to her work with women of other cultures. And Taimalie Kiwi-Tamasisi said, actually, what you can offer the most is to work with other white men and use your influence there, and then we can later collaborate. Anyway, I'm not telling that story very well, but it's possible to read about it. But there's this long history that also therefore relates to cross-cultural partnerships, partnerships between dominant colonizing peoples, of which I'm also a part, and Indigenous peoples, and their efforts also to develop partnerships. And there's a group called the Just Therapy Team from Aotearoa, New Zealand, and Kiwi-Tamasisi is a part of that. And there's also a white man called Charles Waldegrave and Maori practitioners. And they really led the way in these sorts of cross-cultural partnerships and cross-gender partnerships. So your question about what makes this work is there was a lot of rigor, a lot of dedication, but also genuine great care, friendship, and long-lasting relationships, one could say love, between some of these key people who are coming together across differences to try to address great harms. And those examples are very, very significant to me.
So what you are mentioning is the very long story and also the wish and the willingness to go together, even when it's a cross-cultural relationship and really see each other and go there and do the next step. That's what I understand. And when I'm thinking now of the last year or the last past month we have all experienced all over the world, would you say that you just continue with your work because it's still as valid as before and nothing has happened and you just continue in this building relationships and working that intensively with these groups? Or has there been some, I don't know, let's say some crack or something where you could say, well, maybe I have lost a bit this link to society or to my community because something happened? Did you feel something like that because of, what happened with us?
I felt certainly things changed, but I mean, when changes happen or when different events take place, what I'm and what our team is interested in is trying to form collaborations or think about what sort of projects could be put into place that might support people to respond to those hardships. And here in Australia, we've been incredibly lucky and really relatively unaffected. I'm not saying we haven't been affected, but just relatively unaffected in terms of COVID-19. We've had restrictions, but they haven't been anything. The loss of life hasn't been in any way comparable. But we are connected to many, many people in different parts of the world where there has been profound losses and hardships. And so certainly everything, a huge number of things changed. But what became important was to work out, well, what projects could be initiated? And in particular, whose knowledge, whose insider knowledge could be elevated? And Mark, when you were talking about rescuing people's words, within narrative practice, we are extremely interested in honing in and honouring the insider knowledge of particular peoples or perspectives that often get overlooked. So, for example, early on in March, well, a few different things happened. First of all, when COVID-19 occurred in Wuhan, well, we have many Chinese colleagues and narrative practitioners, and they were grappling with all of this well before any of us. And well before we knew this was going to become a global pandemic, we wanted to reach out to colleagues there. In fact, I was asked to give some sort of presentation via WeChat. And so just reaching out and trying to make connections, really acts of friendship these were, before the pandemic traveled, before we knew it was going to be our issue, we were trying to build on those friendships. And so I gave that presentation and then it was subtitled in Chinese, and through our friends and colleagues had various exchanges. And only after that did we realize, actually, what they're learning there is going to be really important for us to know. And months later, it was the people in China who were then sending messages back to us. And there's been some quite beautiful exchanges between Chinese colleagues and colleagues here in Australia, which was also important because racism also increased here in Australia. Anti-Asian racism increased. And so we were also trying to think how to respond to that. And in some way, these exchanges were a part of it. So that was just the first sort of step or initiative. But I'll just tell you the second one. There have been a whole stack of them, so I don't know. I won't just go on and on and on. But I'll just tell you at least one more. Because then when things started to get so uncertain, so nerve-wracking, this is before we knew how bad or not things were going to be in Australia, people were understandably feeling extremely worried and anxious. And I was meeting with some colleagues who have a lot of experience with dealing with panic and worry. And these are people who've had significant mental health struggles, actually. They're peer workers who, many have been hospitalized at times, dealing with really significant anxiety or what's called depression. These are folks who know worry and panic more than most. And so actually they created this very beautiful, thoughtful document about some of their wisdom, hard-won knowledge about dealing with panic. And this was as an offering to the general public at this time when everybody was feeling panicked and worried to some extent. So this was like a collective document, and then it could be shared. And actually it became shared very widely, both here in Australia, but also translated into other languages. So these were the sorts of initiatives that became the focus for us, how to honour particular insider knowledge that would be of value now, but it might not be coming from professionals. It might not be coming from just from the experts. It might be coming from different lived experience, and we could use our skills as narrative practitioners to rescue these words, to record them or document them in ways that would be resonant to others, and then facilitate these exchanges. So there's been a lot of that sort of approach going on, and I've got other stories to share, but I feel I should also give you some room to ask another question rather than me just go on.
Well, just think like we ask you all the questions, like share stories that are resonating and relevant. So feel free to choose. What I learned is that once pressure increases, well, usually the standard pattern to react on that is to become more tense and to become more focused and to become more anxious. You seemingly start to do exactly the opposite, like, okay, who has already experienced this sort of phenomenon? And then it's more like you are more active and more making those connections, like who has already suffered that one, I'd like to amplify that. And so it seems like you are one of the ones that really said, like, okay, then it's get going. The times are tough. It's even increasing engagement rather than to focus and sit back. How do you have this wisdom where to look to? Where is the new normal? How to find where to focus with the narratives you have, because you're constructing the world in this way.
I think you've described that very evocatively, and I really do resonate with that. There's a bit of a story I could tell about that philosophy, about really trying to turn to particular places for the answers and not others. And it really is influenced by Paulo Freire, Brazilian educator, who I had the great honour to meet with Cheryl White many years ago. And when I was meeting with him, we were trying to talk about work in relation to homelessness. And I was being asked by Cheryl White, the director of Dulwich Centre, to document some initiatives about homelessness. And while we were in Brazil, had the opportunity to meet with Paulo Freire, a radical educator. And while meeting with him, a number of things happened in that meeting, but I really only got to ask one question, and I tried to ask him how would some of his principles be able to be applied in relation to people who are homeless. And when I asked that question, he became like a flame. I don't know if you know people who, you know, very, very passionate about particular politics or ethos, and their eyes light up, and he just became a most wonderful positive force came, but quite critical at the same time. And he was basically saying, now that question is basically all that is wrong with neoliberal fatalism. That question, when you ask me, how would we work with the homeless? Do I look homeless to you? We were in his house. I cannot know the answer to that question. The only people who can know the answer to that question are people who are homeless. And what happens is that people of privilege, which was basically me and many others, you look for answers in the wrong places and then get hopeless about any possibility of broader social change. And he was imploring me, and I was quite young at the time, and he was very old. In fact, he died. He went to hospital only one day after this interview. So in some of his last words, he was imploring us to look for the answers in the right places, meaning you don't not just turning to the so-called experts, but turning to the people who have the hard-won insider knowledge about any of these social issues, and then finding ways, as you say, to amplify their knowledge, to collaborate with them. And that's really where collective narrative practices spark from, to try and respond to that challenge, that invitation. So when COVID-19 came around, I can't possibly know how to respond in these different places, and effects are different everywhere. But through collaborations and partnerships, we can amplify the skills and knowledge of diversity of peoples and play some role that also feels meaningful and, you know, personally fulfilling, and therefore an antidote to despair. So, yeah, I appreciate your question.
When you work like this, you are going to those who deeply know, and you try to tell their stories, to identify the narratives and to amplify in this way. I'm wondering, the situation we are facing right now is often that there are several, but not a lot of experts who know what to do or who tell their reality, their things. And my feeling is, well, but there are a lot of wisdom. There's a lot of wisdom around, and there are a lot of people who know from deep inside and who have maybe another feeling or another wisdom, another expertise to tell. First question is, how could you take these narratives nowadays in our societies? And second question is, how to make the others to listen to these narratives? Because that's the second step. You have narratives to tell, but then you need people who listen. If not, there is this expert's view that we only see one thing and don't see what is all around.
Hmm. 2 weeks, we were about to have our master's program, our face-to-face teaching block, and people from many different parts of the world and different parts of Australia were going to come together in March. And about 9 days before this was to take place, we realised this wasn't going to happen, so it had to go online. And during this online teaching block, someone from Turkey, his name's Mehmet Dink, he was noticing that, you know, as in different countries, people were going into quarantine, children were having to no longer be in schools, you know, life was being transformed. There were many, many forms of expert advice that were being given, particularly to parents about, you know, what to do, how to formally educate the kids from home, how to do homeschooling, how to keep this all going. And a lot of it, you know, some of it might be useful, but there was a lot of it. But Mehmet had this idea that actually maybe we could consult different experts. Maybe we could consult children. Maybe we could ask the children what they think would be valuable to do when in quarantine. And he suggested this during this master's block. And there were two Aboriginal Australian colleagues in the training, and they were the first two who thought, this is a fantastic idea. I'm going to go and consult the children in their lives. So they just started consulting, and it's a range of questions that we could then ask kids, and generated this guidebook, a guidebook for parents and caregivers from children. And it was also just, it was fun, you know, in the face of worry and difficulty, and it was also, the kids had such unexpected things to say. Like, everybody was so worried about education systems, and it was my niece just said, oh, why don't you just forget about formal education and do something you don't usually do as a family, just spend time together. And one other kid said, oh, look, you know, we've got more time to create our zoos, our insect zoos, and to have tea parties for slugs. And anyway, you can just imagine these completely non-normative ideas were suddenly bubbling up, and parents and caregivers, it was such a relief because they could not only maybe try out some of these ideas, and there were some wonderful ideas, but they could also just consult their kids and make some plans rather than try and force their kids to do what the experts are saying they should be doing as a family. And it was really delightful. And it was delightful for us as we were putting it together. And in relation to your second part of your question, how do you, you know, find an audience? Because that is crucial. That's a crucial part also of this work. We want to elicit, and we use narrative skills to, you know, richly describe these skills and knowledges of communities. It doesn't just happen, because if you just ask someone, you know, to tell you your ideas, it might be quite a thin telling. It might not be resonant. So there are skills involved in these processes. But then, yes, we also want to find an audience. And one of the things that I found quite delightful is that, because I work at Dulwich Centre and also at the University of Melbourne, the University of Melbourne is one of the elite universities. It's done some fantastic things during COVID-19 that are about expert, particularly medical and scientific expert advice, which has been vital during this time and that the Australian government has listened to, which has been fantastic. But it's actually a bastion of expert knowledge. But this guidebook of children's knowledges, which actually embraced by the Dean of Medicine within the formal university, and it was, you know, sent out and celebrated at the same time. So there was this, in the same event at the University of Melbourne, there was incredibly important, highly expert scientific knowledge being valued, which we really needed in this year, and the knowledge, advice, quirky insider knowledge of children, providing relief and alternative philosophies, actually, about what we could be doing during quarantine. So, yeah, it's those kids and their contributions, you know, really have made a lot of difference to us this year. And in the history of narrative practice, children's knowledges have also been really influential.
And just one last question. So what you did to find an audience is to collaborate with an institution?
Well, it varies. Often what we're trying to do is we're trying to think who, first of all, we're thinking who has the hard-won knowledge and who could they make a contribution to? So the audience is usually who could they make a contribution to? Now, in this case, Melbourne and Victoria are the people in Australia who've had the longest lockdown, longest quarantines in Australia. In fact, they had a very, very long lockdown. And so the University of Melbourne, it didn't just represent an institution at this point, because often it's unusual for us to be circulating these knowledges through institutions, actually. But in this instance, they were also at the heart of those who've been most affected. It was people in Melbourne, people in Victoria, which is the state where Melbourne is in. They'd been the folks who've been with their kids in their homes under restrictions for many, 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 many months. So actually the ethos or the principle was more who could this knowledge make the most significant contribution to, or who would it be most resonant for? So we're trying to find those resonances and facilitate and enable contribution. That's how that usually happens. But in this case, and we use all the relationships that we have. So these might be personal relationships, community relationships, international relationships, or in this case also institutional relationships.
I just wonder, because I have a smile on my face, I think, since 5 minutes, because I feel like, okay, are we talking to the right person with you, David? What we want to understand is, like, what is the big question? What is the new utopia? I'll be talking to you as an expert in some extent. The resonance I have is more to you as a person and as part of the society, and you're both at the same time. And I just wondered whether you are the person who has this specific knowledge, who has the hard-won experience that we have. And I feel, yes, we do exactly talk to the right person. So what we have, one of the habits of our...
It's probably all going to go downhill now, Mark.
Yeah. So... why not? I mean, it's easier to walk downhill in some regard. It's not so good to the overview. We have a habit that our former guest, it's Kirsten, and she gave us a question for you. That is what we are going to ask you as well. And she asked, David, what are you longing for? Or what do you need at this moment of time where we feel there's a crack there's something moving. What are you longing for, or what do you need with the perspective to the bigger picture?
Oh, so I get to ask someone else a question after this, do I? Do I try and think of a very difficult one, or?
Yeah.
I'm glad you also said that the ums and ahs get edited out. It's the only thing that get edited out. I read that, so I might and ah a bit more for a few moments now.
Yes, that's good. It's not going to be edited out because it's part of our beautiful journey.
Look, I've already spoken to this, but it's friendships and partnerships that mean the world to me and make my work and life sustaining. So I just need them to continue, really. And because without them, I just wouldn't be able to respond to contemporary and ever-changing social sufferings. And for whatever reason in this lifetime, if I can't feel I'm making some contribution, then, you know, there are a lot of hardships and injustices in this world, and I just want to play some part, small part, to respond. And I can't do that without collaborations and partnerships and friendships, and they bring me great sustenance and joy and unexpected developments. For instance, here in Australia at the moment, I don't know if you've heard, but there was a report just came out that announced and exposed war crimes that our Australian troops had participated in Afghanistan. And to be honest, it didn't surprise me that our troops had committed war crimes in Afghanistan. I believe that war crimes have been committed in Afghanistan by all foreign forces, and terrible, terrible things have happened there. What was surprising is that these things have been named, and that our general actually spoke to these and has acknowledged them. Now, the reason I mention this is that I have a friendship who I actually met through cricket originally, strange sport that is not played much in Germany, but anyway, but it is played in Afghanistan and it is played in Australia. And I have a friendship with an Afghani man called Dr. Abdul Stanigzai, who's a human rights activist in Afghanistan, and he investigated many of these abuses. He documented them before he became a refugee, fearing for his life from the Taliban, and now lives in Adelaide. Now, because of this friendship, when this abuse is named in Australia, and I, amongst many others, feel terrible about this horrible, unlawful killings that Australians have done in Afghanistan, it's only because of this friendship that I've got a chance to do anything. Otherwise, I'd just be watching the TV and feeling horrible and terrible. But because I have this friendship with Dr. Cricket, as we refer to him, we could talk and say, well, what shall we do? And we want to create some sort of Afghani-Australian friendship projects that will bring together Afghani-Australians, will bring together military veterans and whistleblowers, and offer something back to the villagers in Afghanistan. And that changes my whole orientation to this horrible event. It's still horrible, and I still feel, you know, very saddened about it, but because of the friendship, we can do something. I'm really looking forward to where that project leads. It'll be challenging, but it's something we can do together. So in response to the question, that's what I need to continue, these friendships and collaborations, to be able to take action when the next horrible thing turns up.
David, our time is nearly over, and still I have a question on my mind for quite a long time, and I would like to ask you this question, even if it's a bit too late to do that, maybe. Hearing you, listening to you talking about the importance of friendship and this relationship and the also little narratives, the stories of communities, of people, and listen to them and bring them to the big whole, I'm wondering, what do you think? Is it possible to change the big narrative of a whole society, like the narrative we are telling each other every day? Or Does it exist, this big narrative?
I don't know. I guess there are many big narratives, I guess, aren't there, that we're responding to in some ways. So I don't know if I can think of there just being one big one. And I don't know if I ever have the sense that I, or even through our collaborations, I just don't have any idea of what's possible. It's not that I don't think it's possible, but I think what propels me forward is just creating the foundations for further change. And one of the other things that Paulo Freire talked about is he used to talk about that he might never see the changes that he's working for in his lifetime, and that he doesn't expect to see them, but that maybe through his actions and collaborations, people in the future might just have to work slightly less hard in order to achieve those changes. And that sort of orientation is meaningful to me, because now here in Australia, we're working against over 200 years of colonization in this land that's done incredible harm. And the colonial practices are continuing. So it's not really possible to imagine those things being, you know, overturned in this lifetime. But at the same time, there are just fantastic initiatives and collaborations and partnerships and work that are taking place. And so I think I'm more orientate to really noticing those things, honouring them and celebrating them, and thinking that the people who come after us might just hopefully have to work slightly less hard to achieve the things that we would love to see now.
And we could continue, and I think the number of questions I have grows, so we just need to decide when to follow that up. But that's not in the event today, David. Tina, I feel like there is a line that resonates with me. What resonates with you from those 45 minutes that you've heard? What is on your heart if you have this episode?
Well, there are a lot of more questions now. When I'm thinking of our first question, what is on the agenda now, or what is on now? I have a lot of questions, but what I learned and what is resonating is this longing for deepen relationships, and starting really with those who can tell, and asking them and harvest the wisdom around you that you don't see. So what I'm feeling now is really to go out and look a bit differently to the people surrounding me, and asking them, even if I do that a lot, asking them even more, what do you think and what do you experience and what is your expertise to make it heard? Because that is what touched me, to take people serious, everyone, and to start with, yes, friendship and love. You named it, even if it's difficult to say it out loud, this word in public, it's always a bit strange, but you also talked about love, and that is what's resonating in me.
I know it's probably my time to be quiet and your turn to say your resonances, but I just wanted to mention one other thing, because I was reminded, because when you were talking about Vienna, Mark, I don't know if it was your group, I can't remember exactly what year it was, but there was one time I was in Vienna with Cheryl White again, and in the middle of the workshop, Cheryl kept saying to me, "You must read your letter to your great-grandfather." I was like, "No, not now, maybe after the break." And Cheryl was going, "No, you must read it now. It's really important." I said, no, we'll do it after the break." And then Cheryl turned to the whole group and said, "Would you like to hear David's letter to his great-great-grandfather? Because it was he was a key figure in colonial Australia, and David was asked by Aboriginal people to somehow try to come to terms with these histories." And so, of course, all the group said, "Oh, yes, we'd like to hear it now." So Cheryl's very smart such matters. So I read this letter out, which is trying to come to terms with my own family histories in the colonisation of Australia, which included participation in the frontier wars and the devastation that my people have done to Aboriginal Australia. And I didn't know why Cheryl wanted me to read it out, but when I read this, because it's a direct letter, he's been dead for almost 100 years, but it was just a way of also connecting and honouring my ancestry, because this was the request from Aboriginal Australia. It wasn't to condemn them. It was to somehow speak honestly about these histories, but connect with ancestry. So I read this in Vienna, and there was the most extraordinary silence during this reading. And after the reading, it was too intense to speak. And so we had to have a break. We just could tell that there was too much emotion in the room to speak. And it was only during the break when people would come up to us and name how their own families were connected with World War II histories, with Nazi histories, with Jewish histories. Some people of Jewish heritage were in the room and had been. Anyway, the family connections to these broader societal histories were so significant and yet still so difficult to find ways to speak about that I haven't ever forgotten it. And over this last year, the other thing that I've been really involved in is finishing a series of letters to my great-great-grandfather and trying to come to terms further with these histories in order to make action more possible in the present. So I just wanted to mention that whenever I've been doing that, I've actually always remembered Vienna and Austrian and German colleagues and people living in the present, trying also to come to terms with our family connections to profound events.
Thank you for sharing this story in the end. Mark, share your story with us, please. What resonated on you?
I've just been added one more question to my agenda. This is going through my through the letters to my family, and that may have a resonance which is pretty actual. Today, what I saw is it's all about friendships and partnerships. It's about relation. So that's one of the major pillars of the utopia that I take. So it's not about institutions. It's more about personal relationships and how to expand this further. Also with an idea of how to create a network around the world and do this more deliberately than just to share friendships. And the justice, maybe the wrong word there. I also heard that you thought about what is the big narrative, and maybe to add an S. So what are the big narratives that are there that may have resonance with each other to talk about the real essence that I have learned, whom to talk to? And I saw David inheriting basically those blazing eyes of Paulo Freire, saying, okay, you want to understand the world, you're looking for the answers in the wrong places. So that's maybe my exclamation mark that I take with me. But David, that's our resonance. Did we kind of grasp what you felt is the essence of the narratives and stories you shared?
I've just enjoyed our conversation, and it's made me think back on this year and then also think back to my times in Vienna. And then think back even further in relation to the big narratives here in Australia and our what's significant here on Kaurna land. If I could paint the visual picture on that canvas that you were mentioning at the beginning, I'd paint the hundreds of different nations that are here in Australia. That I always show at every beginning of each of my workshops. There's a visual depiction of this continent, and there are hundreds and hundreds of different colours, hundreds and hundreds of different nations, of different languages, different philosophies, and my people try to whitewash all of that. And it's really meaningful to have friendships and partnerships in the present to try to engage differently with that big narrative and spark something different for future generations.
And David, if you think back of this conversation we have had today with this title, What's Actually Pending Now?, what would be your title of this special episode?
Of this conversation?
Yes.
I think I'd have to think about that. Titles make a difference, don't they? In narrative practice, you know, what title you give to something, how you name a theme in a collective document, it really does shape how the reader then engages with it. So I reckon I will not answer your question, and I'd have to give it some considerable thought about what title I would give it to. So I'll leave that in your capable hands.
And is it possible, because you said the title is so, and I agree, a title is so important to also show the others what they maybe listen to. But we do it the other way around. We ask you listen to yourself, And what would be the title then you would give to your story after having told it? Or not your story, maybe also your thoughts and what popped up. What is it that's on the surface now? Oh, you don't like this.
I don't like it. We just traversed lots of different territories, didn't we? So I guess I'd say something general like stories from down under.
Stories from down under, is that the title, or would you like to refine it or to give it a subtitle or a series of subtitles? Or is that it for the moment?
I think I should just listen to my technological gods, which crashed when I tried to come up with the title last time. So I reckon let's go with that, unless I send you a subtitle.
That we do.
Great. And one other thing, you already thought of it yourself. We are going to ask you what would be the question you would like to ask our next guest without knowing who this will be.
If you were to think about your life as a team, any sort of team, it could be a sporting team, who would be your goalkeeper, the person who is protecting the goals for your team? How about that? Or who would be your coach, the people or figures alive or no longer alive who taught you the most? Either of those two alternative questions from the team of life narrative approach.
Okay, thank you. Mm-hmm.
David, we have had a wonderful hour now with basically starting a conversation that will probably not be easily ending, but it starts a lot of resonances. Thanks very much.
Pleasure.
From up here to down under, or vice versa. I don't know how you see that from an Australian perspective or a Ghana perspective, Ghana land. Thank you very much for sharing a lot of insights, and also thank you for sharing a perspective on a today's society that is from a different angle and therefore enriches and broadens our understanding. Thanks very much indeed.
It's a pleasure. Great being with you. Good luck with your winter.
Thank you, David.